Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxanne Panchassi. My guest today is Thomas Dodman, the author of What Nostalgia Was, War, Empire, and the Time of a Deadly Emotion. And the book was published by the University of Chicago Press in 2018. Hi there, Thomas.
Hello, Roxanne.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Could you get us started by telling us a little bit more about yourself and what got you interested in working on France originally?
Sure. So in retrospect, it almost feels as if this was always meant to be. I went to French schools and did all of my schooling in the Francophone system. And that was mostly down to my mother being a bit of a Francophile and teaching in French school in Florence, which is where I grew up. In a way, I feel as if I'm a product of that French imperial nation state's civilizing mission, and I'm a sort of pure product of the Republican ethos. And so French culture and history was what I grew up with. Now, I ended up almost taking a side route. Well, I took a side route and almost ended up going elsewhere when I went to university in the UK. At the time, I thought of it as a flirt, but I think it really was a real love story with the Bolsheviks and the Russian Revolution. And so for a second, I almost traded Jacobins for Bolsheviks, did a lot of stuff, did my BA and my MA in Russian, late Imperial Russian and early Soviet history. And when it came to, well, first of all, deciding if I wanted to be a historian, that's partly what redirected me towards French history, because my first mentor in London was Rebecca Spang. And one of the most important things that she asked me to do was go to Paris, get into an archive and decide whether I had archive fever. And so I went to Paris, got into the archive, got a complete kick out of being in the archives and realized, okay, this is something I want to do. So check that box. And then she encouraged me to move to the States, and I went to the University of Chicago for my PhD and could have gone the Russian route. But as a friend very, very sort of simply put it to me, he said, well, you know French and you don't know Russian. And as far as I know, that those evening language lessons in Russian aren't going so well. So that was that. And the other thing was, well, where do you want to spend your research time, in Paris or Aix-en-Provence or in Moscow or somewhere else in Siberia? And so that settled things very quickly. And I rapidly sort of moved back to French history and found the sort of ideal French history committee at Chicago with Jan Goldstein, Bill Sewell, Laura Auslander, and together with Moish Poston, they formed my dissertation committee. And so very quickly I became a French historian.
And the focus on nostalgia, how did that come?
The nostalgia thing came at the end, and this is something that you will be familiar with given your own trajectory. It came at the end of a seminar on memory studies and memory and history, which was a joint seminar taught by Laura Auslander and Michael Geyer on French and German perspectives. And right at the end of that seminar, the very last session was on memory disorders, memory troubles. And there I read Svetlana Boehm's book, which you know well as well. And so I stumbled across these stories in the footnotes to that book where she mentions these French soldiers who apparently died of nostalgia back in the French Revolutionary epoch. And so I thought, okay, I have to write a seminar paper. This sounds like something fun, and I need an excuse to go to Paris and do some research. And so I'm going to go to Paris to these military medical archives that apparently track down this phenomenon in the French army. And so I went to Paris for 10 days, got into these archives again completely fortuitously because it was a very difficult thing to do at the time, and all of a sudden realized, my gosh, I have material here for an empirical seminar paper that eventually sort of snowballed into a dissertation and eventually a book. So it was really a sort of chance encounter with a topic, with the archives, and with something that enabled me then to thread into this object other things that I was more interested in, that we probably can come back to.
So Thomas, nostalgia is a topic, a field of interest for historians and across, you know, multiple disciplines. And yet your book sort of explores this relatively, well, uncharted, neglected territory in the history of thinking about nostalgia. I sort of think of it as a prequel in a way. Could you say a little bit about how this book is positioned in relationship to what might already be familiar to listeners?
Yes. Well, when I started, I had a much clearer idea about what I did not want to do. Mm-hmm. The topic seemed to lend itself to this kind of history that I wanted to do because of the fact that it could be approached through an empirical lens, through an archival approach. There were archival sources that would enable me to tell the story not just through novels, not just through printed sources that circulated among a very restricted number of educated people, mm-hmm. but this was actually a phenomenon that was affecting large sectors of the population in a sociologically meaningful fashion. With the archival empirical approach, there was a way of telling a story that nostalgia has a history itself, and that it doesn't have to taint the way we view the past. On the contrary, by historicizing this object, we can denaturalize it, tell it like it isn't, rather than letting it tell the past like it wasn't, and actually sort of explore many other things through this object, which is really what I ultimately wanted to do.
The book really stands, I guess, at the nexus of military history, war and empire, the history of medicine, history of emotions, and I'm sure I'm not covering all of the intersections here. But just to talk about the history of emotions for a moment, if you could just tell us a little bit about how you see the book intervening in what has become a really kind of proliferating field.
Yeah, what you were mentioning just before is really what I like about the project. Studying nostalgia enabled me to do what I like to think of as a form of histoire totale, as a kind of, not a totalizing history, but a history that refuses to parse out segments and treat them in isolation from one another. And so I felt that what I had here was an objet d'histoire, a problématique that would enable me, that only made sense if contextualized deeply in many contexts, and hence the military, the medical, the colonial, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Emotions obviously is one of those aspects, and it came into the project rather late. I caught the wave of the sort of cresting, rising wave of the history of emotions as it was forming. And there's a certain instrumental intent in doing that. This, it seemed like something exciting that was happening, and that it's always good to be on a wave of historiographical renewal.
Sure.
But obviously this made a lot of sense too. Nostalgia is something that we think of as a form of affect, a feeling, an emotion. I mean, those words get somewhat slippery and overlap. I have to say, I'm not, even though I go to History of Emotions conferences, I contribute to books on the history of emotions, this is obviously something that I now do. Mm-hmm. It's definitely not, for me, the main focus of the book. It's not the thing that most attracted me in the project as it developed. The way I view it is more that what I try to do is a history that does not leave the emotions out, rather than a history of emotions per se. And in that respect, I see myself following more in a certain French tradition that is partly that of the Annales, partly that of Alain Corbin's work, and so the history of sensibilité more in general. So in a very modest way, I hope the book makes a contribution to raising awareness about the fact that we do need to historicize affective categories. We do need to find the ways to integrate this dimension of historical actors into our protocols of historical research. And that's really what I'm much more interested in pursuing, you know, with this book and with future projects, rather than the history of an emotion per se, which is interesting, but is relatively limited in its purchase.
The book, Thomas, covers this span of 200 years. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the start point, specifically 1688. But before we do, I just wondered if you wanted to say something about the broad periodization of the book and the bookends, the late 17th to the late 19th century.
Yeah, sure. I guess the first thing I would want to say is that I hope I don't say anything, or at least too many things, that are outrageously wrong, because both the beginning and the end are somewhat out of my domain of expertise, or at least where comfort, especially the beginning, which I'm not at all a specialist of late 17th century Alsace and Switzerland, which is really not what I expected to be writing about. And the end, also sort of late 19th century France, it's closer to what I know, but it's also a little bit out of my stricter domain of chronological competence. More importantly, I guess what interested me about those two limit dates, which, you know, they were imposed upon me by the object of study. That's when nostalgia is born, and when I argue it ends its first life as a medical category. Mm-hmm. It does somewhat kind of roughly map onto what I would view as the first phase, or at least the first full phase of development of what I'm calling the sort of capitalist epoch, first phase of modernity, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And so we start with the late 17th century general crisis, as economic historians call it, a period of instability, of economic transformations, of social transformations, of environmental transformations, as some of the more recent research has pointed to. And we end with the quantum leap of the second industrial revolution, the turn of the 19th, early 20th century, and the passage into sort of fully fledged capitalist modernity in the North Atlantic world.
In the introduction to the book, Thomas, you make the point that, and I'm quoting you here, that it undoubtedly was the French that paid the highest tribute to the disease in this period.
Yep.
Whenever I'm working on something and someone says, what's French about this? Or what is distinctly French about this? It's a question I always find so frustrating. And yet here I am, the host of a French studies podcast, and I find myself asking this question all the time. So what was so French about nostalgia in the period that you're looking at in the book?
Well, the flippant response to that is that, you know, who but the French could be so much victims of nostalgia, right? More seriously, this is a problem that I grappled with throughout the dissertation and throughout the revisions leading into the book, and that I don't think I have fully quite squared. And that comes across in some of the first reviews of the book that have come out. Nostalgia is a general phenomenon. It's not an exclusively French phenomenon. It is tied to the transformations of capitalist modernity. And we can say that because it's not just something that happens in France. This pathological form of nostalgia that I track is something that we see in France, but also in armies across Europe, North America. You see it in the colonies and in various other parts of the world as well. Now, that said, it does acquire a whole very special kind of importance in France and elicits a lot more interest, a lot more literature, a lot more research, for a number of reasons, and I tried to enumerate those in the book. Some of them are very simple and practical, including the fact that France has one of the sort of largest standing armies of conscripts from the French Revolution, the Napoleonic Wars onwards, and this is very much part of the French tradition. Mm-hmm. And that's connected, I argue, to nostalgia. This also means that from very early, from the 17th century, the French army has the leading military medical corps in the world. Mm-hmm. This corps has a vested interest in finding new diseases upon which it can exert its expertise as a way of claiming professional recognition. There are other reasons that have to do with the peculiar political culture of a country that was a pioneer in forms of democratization with the revolution and extending sovereignty and human rights, et cetera, et cetera, but at the same time was reimposing forms of what I would call abstract heteronomy or forms of domination that are impersonal, that have to coexist with a legal system that otherwise is predicated on the idea of universal equality and rights for everyone. So this is something that I thought you can see happening in France more so than elsewhere. The other place where it would happen, and it did happen, and I wish I'd had more time, more energy, more will to actually do the research, is of course in the US, in the United States. And of course, the last major war where nostalgia is sort of recorded on a systematic basis by military doctors is the American Civil War. Mm-hmm. And there you have a similar kind of situation of soldiers who are conscripts but endowed with inalienable rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and find themselves in forms of domination that otherwise should not be inflicted upon them.
The first chapter of the book, Thomas, Nostalgia in 1688, is a kind of wonderful origin story of the term and the diagnosis, and it turns around this figure, Johannes Hofer. So tell us about Johannes Hofer and why he's so important to this study.
This is, as you say, it's a wonderful story because we actually have the invention of a word, and it's important to ask ourselves this question, because Hofer hesitated whether he should call this nostalgia or Philo Patridomania or Nozo something. I'm forgetting them now, but
way less marketable.
Way less marketable, and in doing the research, I often found myself doing counterfactual histories of what would the world look like if he had chosen something a lot less pleasing to the ear than nostalgia. But in any case, I really got interested in doing a kind of an attempt at a micro history of the world in which Johannes Hofer evolved. And what's interesting about him is that he's an otherwise fairly unremarkable figure who doesn't leave much of a trace in history, except for the fact that he's the longest standing mayor of his hometown of Mulhouse, which I suppose does give him some historical clout. But in the medical world profession, he definitely is not one of the major figures at all of this age of important age of revolution in medical knowledge. Very quickly, I came to the conclusion that I would only find a solution to why he decided to invent nostalgia by looking at it contextually. What were the kind of things that he was worrying about? And it turns out that this is a moment of major anxiety in that part of Europe. Mulhouse's independence depends on Swiss mercenary soldiers who are sent to Mulhouse to protect it whenever the city is at risk, mostly from Basel, which is right nearby. And that there have been reports of these Swiss guards succumbing to a form of melancholia, and that this is a real challenge to the survival of his hometown. And so he basically invents a medical category, making the point very explicitly that it can be cured, that it is something that you can recover from given the right kind of medical treatment, precisely to undercut the kind of problems that the mercenary system, the Swiss Guard mercenary system is getting itself into at the time with the transformations in military recruitment that were ongoing.
I think the thing that surprised me most about the sort of origin story is, how rooted it is in the experience of war. And the idea that you emphasize that, well, throughout the book, that nostalgia is a disease or a pathology that doesn't just characterize soldiers, but is unique or has a specific history, a specific military history, because it requires isolation. I think your words are isolation and estrangement in a foreign land, that it's about spatial displacement coupled with social disembedding. Can you say a little bit more about this social disembedding?
Right. The first thing I guess to say is that for Hofer, this is not explicitly a military disease. And that's an important point for him, because he's trying to suggest that Swiss soldiers are not bound to suffer from this. This is something that is, I think he sees, is tied to the social transformations that are leading people to move further and further away from their homes, their networks of sociability, and oftentimes not just for seasonal migration, but increasingly for durable forms of displacement. And that's what's leading them to feel disembedded, what I would call disembedded, from the kind of networks of close-knit sociabilities that they may have known up until that point. The army ends up being emblematic of this, and I think this is where the army really serves as a sort of laboratory for the transformations of modern society. And there's a wonderful book by Alain Ehrenberg on this, and obviously Foucault's Discipline and Punish is to a certain extent talking about this too. And what I mean by that is that, and this is the moment when armies cease to be basically traveling societies where there were men, women, children traveling all together in sort of, I think of it as a movable feast kind of thing. It's not the right atmosphere, not the right image, but it's a whole society basically moving along from one campaign to the other. Campaigns are of short duration. They stop for the winter. They pick up again, and it's a sort of normal part of life in many ways, and we move from there to armies that are much more separate from society. There's a distinction between the military sphere and the civilian sphere. It becomes a much more male universe, and becomes a universe of strict discipline and drill, where soldiers are trained to become somebody else in many ways than who they would have been before. And this is a very alienating experience for many of them. And it's in particular the case for these Swiss guards, who up until that time had been able to, on a contractual basis, pledge their allegiance to a particular foreign army, but then go home whenever they wanted. Well, not whenever they wanted, but with the expectation that they would be going home at the end. And they kept their own esprit de corps. They had their own uniforms. They were often recruited locally in sort of bands of brothers, if you want. And that all comes to an end around about this moment when there you are, integrated in a much more systematic, much more quantified, regimented kind of fashion in the French army in particular. And so basically what you have here is a sort of laboratory of microcosm experience of that kind of modern anomie, modern and anonymity, life of sort of anonymous life of modernity that you then see reproduced in colonial worlds, in the city, of course, in the sphere of consumption later on in the 19th century, and that I thought it was worth sort of telling this story to try to also sort of bring military history out of military history, so to say, or rather the history of war and of conflict out of its specific locus in military history to say that this is actually a social phenomenon of significant social impact.
The second chapter of the book, Thomas, really follows. I love the formulation that you use, the phrase nostalgia is a trending medical term through the 18th century and what you describe as this medical republic of letters. So that chapter is also kind of, there's this sort of gift at the beginning of the chapter of the convoluted story of additions of offers study, and then what becomes of the diagnosis and the term through the 18th century. So do you want to give us a sense of what some of the broad transformations of that period are?
Sure. Yeah, and what you were mentioning about the convoluted editorial history of the book is just one of these wonderful gifts that the archives sometimes throw up. And at one point, I realized, wait a minute, this is not the edition of Hoffer's dissertation that I was working on last week. What's happened, and why is it antedated by 10 years when he was only 9 years old? There's something very wrong. And so what that speaks to is a regime of editorial production that is very different to our own, where notions of authorial property and ownership are very different to the ones that we have today. And so what you actually have here is a kind of very empirical case of the death of the author, so to say, and the wondrous afterlife of a text. What I try to do in this chapter, which is really one of the intellectual history chapters of the book, it's really, it's pitched at a level of conceptual history, that departs in some ways from the first chapter and methodologically, and certainly much more so from the subsequent chapters in the book, but it really just tries to trace this meandering trajectory of the concept of nostalgia as it is both splintered and eventually right at the end recrystallizes throughout the medical republic of letters in the 18th century. And broadly speaking, it follows sort of two tracks, that the two schools of medical thought that I can identify vie for who has the better way or the more adequate way of understanding nostalgia. On the one hand, you have a much more materialist, physiological understanding of nostalgia as almost as an organic disease caused by things like pressure differentials when you go up and down a mountain, or the sort of atmospheric pressure, or just the foul atmospheres, which was obviously one of the obsessions of the contagionist medicine of the time. And on the other hand, a form of medicine that pays, a more sensationalist form of medicine that pays attention to the emotions and to the psyche, and that views this much more as a psychological problem that has to do with people's sense of displacement, their affective emotional attachment to something that they have lost and that they therefore might long for. And so I sort of track these two parallel traditions that eventually, I argue, coalesce, or at least sort of find a way of coexisting in the medical practice of medical officers. So if the chapter largely follows debates at the level of medical theory, what we all, those of us who are somewhat interested in medical history, know is that what's crucial about the late 18th century, early 19th century in France in particular, is the switch to medical practice, and that these are no longer sort of armchair doctors debating things. These are actually doctors that have their hands dirty, quite literally, because they're in an anatomical theater and they've got surgery going on, etc. These debates about whether nostalgia is caused by the animal spirits in the blood, or about pressure differentials, or simply because you're longing for something and this is a form of ideational sort of contagion between mm-hmm. people, those become relatively moot points, irrelevant. What matters is that something's going wrong. This soldier is suffering. We need to do something about it. And so what are the kind of therapeutic protocols, the prophylactic measures, the therapeutic protocols that we can put in place? What is the kind of legislation that we need to implement, that we need to get the government to implement in order to make sure that this is not a problem that is going to be too debilitating to the army? So the chapter ends with a switch to the realm of practice, which is a more in general something that I wanted the book to develop, a sort of theory of practice, nostalgia as a form of practice, not just a representation, not just an idea or a concept. And that therefore get us to, I think, a different level of historical experience, a different level of historical research that I switched to in chapters 3 and 4 with the more empirical, archival basis, as opposed to the kind of cultural sources, published material that I had been studying up until that point.
Right. And then these next two chapters, 3 and 4, chapter 3 focuses on the military doctor's perspective.
Right.
And then the fourth chapter focuses on the illness narratives and accounts and experiences of soldiers. In that third chapter, I was really struck by your characterization of nostalgia as you trace its history through the period of the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars as a new, and I'm quoting here, actant of war. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on that that phrase and what that means for you?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can, or at least to your satisfaction, but I'll try. This is where the project all started. The first version of the seminar paper that I wrote back in 2003 was on the French Revolutionary era soldiers, the doctors of this period. And at the time, I was reading some Latour, that's where the notion of the actant, for at least for me, comes from. I wanted to try to give a sense, because this is such an immaterial thing that is somewhat difficult to understand as a force actually impinging upon people and that might be causing historical chains of events. I wanted to actually try to give nostalgia some form of agency, so to say.
You go on in the book, Thomas, from this emphasis on doctors, medical practitioners, the diagnosis, to the sensorial and affective world of soldiers, right, looking at these different narratives, illness narratives, during the period of the Napoleonic Wars. And I guess I want to just ask you about the narratives as a genre. Is there a kind of, well, is that even a good word to describe them? Is there a kind of proliferation of a certain type of illness narrative specific to nostalgia in this period?
I would say yes. Well, it's a little bit complicated. What there certainly is, and I was very glad to find, is a proliferation of ego document narratives, letters, memoirs, journals. As a historian of late 18th, early 19th century, I had a lot of envy. I have a lot of envy of 20th century historians who have an abundance of these kind of subjective sources available. Particularly, World War I is a classic example where you can really sort of get at soldiers' experiences in the trenches, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have as much, obviously, for societies that are a lot less literate, such as early 19th century France. But what I found was that there still is a lot, and that this is really sort of the first moment of a sort of abundance of production. Now, as to whether these are medical narratives or illness narratives, rather, I should say, that's obviously a little bit more difficult of an argument to make. I ended up having to read a lot between the lines because there are very few soldiers who actually speak about their experience of nostalgia explicitly. This is not something you talk about with your parents or with your loved ones to whom you write letters from the front line. The first inclination that you get that nostalgia may change and may cease to be pathological and become a kind of coping mechanism, you find in the memoirs of Napoleonic veterans. So those people who up until that point had suffered from nostalgia or maybe could have died of nostalgia, once the war is over and they are left bereft and they don't have much to look forward to in Restoration France. They're somewhat social pariahs to a certain extent. Many of them are in very difficult financial situations. What they're left with is the forms of sociability that they had nonetheless managed to recreate for themselves in the army. And so what doctors end up noting is what they at the time call a very strange form of nostalgia for the regiment that seems to be sustaining these veterans after the end of the war. That's when I argue you get the first historical example of our contemporary nostalgia as a coping mechanism to change rather than a pathological response to change. And it's also the first moment when you begin to see nostalgia thought of more in temporal terms rather than in spatial terms, as a longing for a period of your life or something that happened before and that is idealized as a nicer past rather than a specific place that you would want to go back to.
After this pairing of chapters on the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic period, the pairing of doctors and practitioners and then soldiers' accounts, the book moves into a golden age for nostalgia.
Right.
This period of the 19th century, looking at how the term, which is really located in this kind of medical discourse, becomes a broader concept and how it, as you argue, gradually became demedicalized and naturalized. So can you tell us a little bit about how that evolution unfolds in this period of the 19th century?
Right. So this is it's a troublesome chapter because it's sort of sandwiched between the two big empirical cases, sort of the empirical test cases of the French Revolutionary Wars and then the colonization of Algeria. I gesture a little bit to the fact that there is a sort of co-opting to a certain extent of the medical literature of nostalgia in forms of romantic literature and aesthetics more in general, that initiate a partial or at least one other contributing factor to a slow burning fizzling out of the medical nostalgia, pathological nostalgia, leading into the more benign form of nostalgia that we are familiar with. This is one factor among many others. In many ways, what's happening here, and there's also, I guess I should mention, there's also the, this is the moment, Stéphane Gerson has studied the moment of you know, beginning of real interest in what do you do with the problem of the local within the national, and, and forms, early forms of regionalism and localism. And so what I try to wrap all of these around the question of, this is a golden age where nostalgia seems to be on everybody's lips, including on doctors' lips. They're churning out dissertations at a ridiculous rate on nostalgia. I ended up counting 70 or 80 odd medical dissertations on nostalgia in these years, which makes nostalgia the second most studied psychiatric disorder in France after hysteria in the 19th century, which is quite remarkable if you think about it. At the same time, doctors are talking more and more about this. It's also the moment when there's a splintering, so to say, of the coherence that the diagnosis had acquired during the Napoleonic Wars because of the practice of actually having to save people's lives. With that gone, the kind of squabbling theoretical debates over what this actually is reappear, similar in that way to what had gone on in the 18th century, but that by the 19th century, they're reappearing on a much broader scale, on a commercial scale too, where all of a sudden you've got things like etiquette manuals latching onto this nostalgia term and integrating it into their own advice manuals on how to behave, what kind of music to listen to, what kind of and topics of discussion to bring up in the salons of early bourgeois culture. And so what you have is a kind of éclatement of the coherence, and nostalgia starts to its apex, its acme of interest is also its moment of undoing, so to say, because it begins to really lose that coherence that it had in medical practice. And you see that reflected in some of the medical sources from the 1830s and 40s, where you get doctors saying, well, are we sure that this is really a disease we want to category that we want to be using? It seems kind of fanciful to me. So that's really what happens to nostalgia, I argue, in the 30s and 40s. But what's key is that it's not a light switch flip. It's not
right.
It's and that's where a point that I wanted to make, and I hope comes across, that it's not as if the revolution happens, everybody's sense of temporality, everybody's regime of historicity changes overnight, and all of a sudden we're in a modern world where the past is separated from the present and we're all nostalgic for a past we have lost, which I'm sort of caricaturing a bit, but there is a sense in which epistemic ruptures, I think that epistemic ruptures, this is a nod to Althusser's autobiography, but epistemic ruptures dure longtemps, they last a long time. they are protracted, the future lasts a long time. I think that's the title of Althusser's autobiography, but so the chapter sets the scene for the rest of the book, and the sort of fitful, protracted process through which nostalgia changes from medical, pathological to benign, emotional, the way we know it, and that's a process that really takes us through the whole 19th century, I argue.
Well, and this rest of the book really looks at changes in the ways that people think about nostalgia, moving from this French and European context and connecting to the history of empire, and in particular the conquest and colonization of North Africa and Algeria specifically. So that's, if chapters three and four are a pair of a kind, six and seven really are a pair of a kind as well. In that first, Nostalgia in the Tropics, that chapter six, you're talking about the story of soldiers and French settlers who suffered from nostalgia during the period of conquest. So what are the kind of broad lines of the problem of nostalgia in and through the conquest and settlement of Algeria in this early period?
The first thing I'd like to say about this chapter is that this is a testimony to the beauty and the extraordinary creativity of archival research, because this is something that I did not foresee embarking upon this research on colonial Algeria. This was really a particular source that I found in archives in Paris mentioning that these soldiers were dying of nostalgia in Algeria, and that made me think, oh, maybe I should go to Aix-en-Provence, right? Why not? To the colonial archives there. And And all of a sudden, I had a whole new area of research for the book, for the dissertation, and then the book that ended up being arguably the most important aspect, I think, of the book. What I found is, well, I guess there are two main things that really come into play that crystallize, I think, in Algeria. On the one hand, this is the moment where I was able to really sort of show that this is not just a military problem, but this is also affecting civilians, the settlers who are either sent to Algeria or migrate to Algeria and end up suffering and in many cases dying of nostalgia in Algeria, live in a very kind of, in a very militarized, regimented world as civilians, but they're subjected to the same kind of forms of heteronomy that that I was talking about earlier with regard to soldiers. What was interesting to me about this was that this baffled at first doctors and ultimately led them to quite explicitly say that, well, actually what we've been calling nostalgia is not just really nostalgia. It's really got to do with a sense of alienation. I mean, they almost, you know, they come within centimeters of using that word, in the Marxian sense of estrangement from oneself, from one's object of work, from other people around us. They use the word obviously because they think of it as a form of madness, and so alienation in French is the word used for madness, including the mild variant of madness that nostalgia is. But I really got at what I was hoping to find from the beginning, namely that nostalgia is a medicalized form of alienation. In the Marxian sense of alienation. So that was very important to me. The second thing, and this is more bleeding into the second chapter of this duo, is that in Algeria, I felt that I was able to trace a decisive factor in the transformation of nostalgia from pathological medical to benign emotional. Once the medical discourse gets plugged into the new scientific, pseudo-scientific discourse of racial theory and degeneration theory. And so what you see very quickly happening is we go from nostalgia being a pathological consequence of people who are unable to adapt to a new environment, social, environmental, psychological environment in the tropics, to nostalgia, actually, perhaps it's a good thing because it's a sign that these French people are not going to engage in the perilous, and I'm using inverted commas everywhere here, the perilous, degenerative creolization that comes from moving into a colonial world and absorbing the air, the atmosphere of Africa, and perhaps even engaging in promiscuity with native populations, and therefore sort of losing their Frenchness, diluting their Frenchness. And nostalgia ends up becoming a kind of a wake-up call against this, and a form of recall to an original, authentic French identity.
It's really fascinating how the diagnosis and the problem moves from being this, you know, sign of imperial failure to take hold and decline, and you know, the failure to acclimatize is the problem, but then it becomes the way to guarantee that these Europeans won't assimilate.
Right, yes. Yeah.
What's also fascinating to me is how this story in the imperial context connects with the story in the French national context of the relationship between the local and the national. So how the local, the national, and the imperial all kind of come together by the end of the book. You talk about the status of the global in this this work, and the way that you're moving, you know, between, I mean, the terms that appear throughout the book, local, transnational, national, regional. And I really felt these things really coming together in these two chapters the end of the book.
Good. Well, I'm glad you felt they came together. I wasn't always sure, but definitely that was the ambition. And knowing full well that I'm not trained as a colonial historian, and so there are obviously potential black spots there, or things that I overlooked. Certainly, lots of things that I overlooked. But it seemed to me as if this transition is happening at the moment when, just a little bit before a discourse of a sort of assimilatory discourse in the colonies gives way in part to a discourse of association, right, with coexisting. Mm-hmm. Of different populations and a recognition of diversity, including a sort of inscribing of diversity in discriminatory legal in a discriminatory legal framework. This is happening at roughly the same moment when the questions of regionalism and nationalism are coming to the fore in France, as you were mentioning. This is, of course, the moment when, again, supposedly French peasants become Frenchmen, but it's also the moment when regionalism becomes hugely important in France. And the nostalgia ended up mediating between these different forms of identification and association to a particular kind of France, an old France that is also a springboard for a new France. And you see this, I think, very concretely in Algeria, in the turn to recreating authentic French villages in Algeria, which is something that obviously fascinated me a lot, and that I ended up trying to theorize in terms of the larger argument of the book as nostalgia being emblematic of a particular form of social transformation, but that I think concretely manifests this coming together of the local, the national, and the global in a concrete form as this authentic French village built by the French in Algeria.
So let's just return to 1884 as this nice moment at the end of the book. We talked about it at the beginning. And of course, I know that that's an important moment, but it comes together at the end of this book in ways that I wouldn't have thought about without thinking about nostalgia, like bringing together these last military cases, military medical cases, the adoption of Greenwich Mean Time, which of course, I guess I know that's then, but wouldn't have put together with this, the scramble for Africa, the artistic avant-garde of the fin de siècle. This moment seems almost too good to be true in the sense of like a really good moment to end the book.
Yeah.
It makes sense to end here, but what do you see as some of the leaking on the other side of 1884?
That's a good question. Let's say that it is too good to be true, and it just happened to be a convenient way to wrap up a story that didn't really have an end point. But the leak, and I like the way you put it, the leaking there is that by 1884, what I can say is that what we have in place is our nostalgia of today, roughly the nostalgia that we've had ever since then, and that's its moment of full maturation at the dawn of a new age of capitalist development. And what I tried to show towards the end of the book is how, by that point, nostalgia is what I'm calling a form of subjectivity that is adequate to its object, that is fully adequate to the forms of temporality and spatiality of modern capitalist society. And what I mean by that is a kind of a dialectical double movement in terms of on the temporality side that is both the sort of runaway, empty, homogeneous time of progress that we are generally quite familiar with and associate to modernity, but that is also another form of time that is cyclical and repetitive, and that sort of constantly dredges up the old and propels it into the future. And the best way, I think, to think about that is the endless, always new cycles of the fashion industry, where the old is always turned into the new. We generally think of nostalgia in terms of that first form of temporality, the linear, accelerating modern time that therefore cuts us off from the past and creates the gap for longing for something we have lost. But what I wanted to show was that what we have by the end of the 19th century is also that second form of temporality that makes it possible to imaginatively recall the past and actually sort of sometimes quite concretely recreate it in the future. Mm-hmm. This is something that hopefully is echoing with your interests from your book, because what I felt I could show in the creation of these villages in Algeria was a sort of perfect encapsulation of this, whereby you end up having multinational joint stock companies floated on the Paris stock market, many of them quite fraudulent in their intent and practices, engaged in the business of recreating authentic French villages in Algeria. So there's a kind of the dialectician there has a problem sort of tearing apart all the paradoxes and contradictions and ironies in that. But what you end up having is modernity both superseding a form of social life, but then recreating that form of social life and propelling it into the future. And something similar, I argue, is happening in on the spatial axis, on the synchronic axis, whereby you end up having forms of sort of expansion, globalization, homogenization of space, mm-hmm. within which constantly get recreated pockets of diversity and locality and particularity. And that, again, the villages, the French villages, I think speak to that in the sort of radiating expansion of French imperialism, what you end up having are little villages of particular French villages that get reproduced elsewhere. Or similarly, in the way in which the Third Republic ends up rather than sort of assimilating and destroying all regional dialects, ends up actually championing the teaching of local languages within the context of the nation, and so you can end up having diversity within universality. So I felt that, and this is it's a difficult kind of thing to fully wrap one's head around and grasp, but these are the forms of temporality and spatiality that I associate, that I think are particular to the modern capitalist epoch, that I think come fully into being by the end of the 19th century, and that the transformation of nostalgia into a benign, naturalized feeling to the point that psychologists end up thinking of it as a basic emotion, as something that is fundamental to human beings, is a reflection of the fact that it is a form of subjectivity most adequate to these forms of temporality and spatiality. And that's why I think we are all nostalgic creatures today, and quite happily live with the paradox that nostalgia is a global phenomenon, but that makes claims to a very particular form of identity that should not be reproducible on a global scale.
So I want to ask a hugely unfair question.
Oh dear.
I guess it came to me as I was reading the afterword, and you say something, I think parenthetically, as you're talking about our kind of contemporary tendency to separate sickness from the comfort mm-hmm. version of nostalgia. And I'm curious, actually, I don't know anything about the specific world of the medicalization or the psychological diagnoses that are accompanying descriptions of displacement and communities and migrants, and I guess it's the world of trauma and PTSD and some of those other kinds of things now. But I just wondered, you know, as you're writing this book and presumably surrounded by a kind of contemporary discourse of trauma, what your mm-hmm. thoughts are on how we use this history to think with more nuance. Right.
It's a very, it's perhaps an unfair question, but a very good question, but one that I unfortunately don't have a very good answer to. The one thing that I keep coming back to is that if the book says anything that is of relevance today, it is that I don't think nostalgia is any outside from capital. Mm. I don't think nostalgia provides us with a standpoint from which we may be able to envisage an alternative to the society in which we live. And in that respect, I differ from somebody like Svetlana Boym, who argued that you could distinguish between a reflective restorative nostalgia and reflective nostalgia, and the reflective nostalgia was kind of the good nostalgia. Restorative was the bad, regressive, right-wing, reactionary kind of nostalgia. I'm suspicious of that precisely because I think what I hope the book shows is that both of those movements are created within the same dialectical logic of capital. The capital creates the possibilities for a reflective nostalgia, but then immediately subsumes them into a restorative nostalgia. And so I don't think the nostalgia provides an outside from which to envisage something different. And I certainly agree, and indulge in it myself, that it provides a comforting form of sustenance and sense of self. And I agree with the work that psychologists do, to neuroscientists, psychologists do today, that basically for whom basically it's a good positive emotion that helps us navigate through moments of uncertainty and dramatic change. The problem, I think, is that I don't think it's possible to dissociate that and keep it separate from the kind of more dislikable forms of political nostalgia that we witness, have witnessed repeatedly over the 20th century and live in a moment of right now. Mm-hmm. And I don't think those two can be kept separate. I think they're two sides of the same coin. And that the only way, if that is true, if I'm right about this, that they are two sides of the same coin, the only possible outcome is to get rid of both of them and to not look back at all, but only look forward. But I realize that sounds very grandiose, and it's not necessarily something one should try to do in practice. And I'm certainly not able to, as somebody who's moved around a lot and left a lot of people behind, it's certainly something that nostalgia is certainly something that I know of at a personal experiential level as well. So, I just don't see how there's a critical potential in nostalgia, because I think it is so intertwined to the social world of the capitalist epoch. I mean, of course, I'm assuming that what it could serve for is that one would want is for it to overcome capitalism.
I'm with you.
That's a big assumption to make, I realize. But I just don't think it provides an adequate standpoint from which to look beyond.
Well, I've got one last question, Thomas,
sure,
which I hope is less unfair, which is, what are you working on now?
Oh, no, that's terribly unfair.
Well, it would stress me out if somebody asked me.
It does. Well, the first thing I'll say is I'm working on too many things, and at some point I need to discriminate a little bit and focus on what's most important. One thing I'm very much involved with is, and that I would be quite happy to mention, is a new French journal called Sensibilité that I become very much involved with, and it's mostly with French colleagues, but we're hoping to give it a little bit more exposure in the Anglophone world in the coming years, but that really tries to explore some of these questions that we've talking about. How do we integrate the world of the of affective life in historical research and social science more in general? It's a very interdisciplinary journal, which has been taking up a lot of my time. The second book that I need to, that I, in a way, I have been working on for a while, but have been sort of leaving aside a lot, is a micro history of, this sounds very untrendy and unsexy, but it's a micro history of a white male French revolutionary era soldier, who is interesting to me insofar as he was adopted and raised to be Rousseau's Émile. And so is a kind of test case for social engineering in the Enlightenment. What makes him even more interesting to the Freudian in me is that he is obviously very much in love with his adoptive mother, but ends up returning home to marry his adoptive stepsister, and becomes mayor of his little village in northeast, in Lorraine, for the rest of his life.
What are you talking about? That's hugely sexy already. Sounds crazy.
Maybe it is, but the other source of interest is that it took me a long time to find his wartime correspondence. Eventually, I found it. There's a whole attempt to sort of right now a very preliminary thinking through of how I would write this, both as a micro history biography, but also as a reflective piece of why we do what we do and why I became interested in this particular object of study. And hopefully the fact that he then becomes mayor and I found the municipal archives where I can track his trace as a bureaucrat, as sort of an administrator, shall we say, helps me to tell a story a little bit about, I guess, I mean, in a way, this is, of course, a concrete family romance of the French Revolution. So I'm trying to rework some of the themes that Lynn Hunt had explored a while ago now, but then fold that into what I would view as a sort of personal dialectic of enlightenment, of how a revolutionary becomes a soldier, becomes an administrator, and eventually a sort of figure of authority. But I think there's a story there that speaks to our time of why some people staunchly refuse the sort of ouverture onto the world and onto encountering different people, and instead decide to focus on their own little community and end up very sort of identifying very strongly with it. Obviously, I'm tying this to forms of identity politics and forms of identitarian politics that we live with today. So,
well, that sounds fantasmatic and fantastic.
Good, now I just have to write it.
And also makes me want to remind you about your translation of Hoffer, because wasn't he a mayor too? There's a mayoral.
There's a mayoral thread. Oh my God! Now you're making me. Yeah, now I'm worried about what I will become. But.
Well, Thomas, I just want to thank you so much for writing this book and for joining me.
Thank you so much, Roxanne, for reading it and for asking me all these great questions.
You've been listening to New Books in French Studies, a podcast series on the New Books Network.